Welcome to Liberty Watch, an independent program on KVOI, Tucson's voice of freedom. Liberty Watch is produced by Charles Heller. The opinions expressed are not endorsed by KVOI, its sponsors, or guests.
And welcome to Liberty Watch on AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, the voice. And this voice is a little raggedy today. I think we have it all set up. I'll get my headphones on. And Dr. Stephen Halbrook, welcome.
Oh, glad to be on the show.
This is an absolutely fascinating book. And let me introduce you a little bit to the audience. Mr. Halbrook is a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He's argued and won constitutional law cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, testified before Congress, and is one of the nation's leading experts on Second Amendment and gun control measures. You were on the panel of attorneys also on both Heller and McDonald, were you not?
I was in the Heller case. I represented the majority of members of Congress in an amicus brief. And in the McDonald case, there were two different groups that were involved in terms of the court hearing from them, and I was on the team that NRA was the lead plaintiff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've done a lot of work for NRA over the years.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
It's such a joy to have you on. You've also written a huge body of work. I remember the first book of yours that I read was back in the 80s, I think about 85 or 86. I know it was published in 84, but I was a little slow then. But the That Every Man Be Armed, I had a paperback copy, so I know I didn't have the original. I do have your book, your definitive book on the Second Amendment, the Founder's Second Amendment, I believe is the book.
Yes, that's right.
That one I got in hardcover when it first came out. I actually went out and bought it. I wasn't going to be cheap and ask a publisher for it.
Right.
Yeah. Just on Foundation, Counselor, what causes, you have an incredibly deep interest in the right to keep and bear arms, more than just being, say, an avid gun enthusiast. What is it that motivates you to be in this work?
Well, I realized when I was an undergraduate in college, I went to the Supreme Court Library of the state of Florida, and I looked in the law review articles that were published on different subjects, including the Second Amendment, and I found there was virtually nothing. This was in the late 60s, and if you go back then, as you know, there was a lot of gun control and prohibition-type legislation being proposed. And in fact, in 1968, the Gun Control Act passed the U.S. Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there was virtually nothing on the Second Amendment that had been published. And you had the invention of this theory that the right of the people to keep and bear arms really meant the power of the state to maintain the National Guard, a completely ludicrous, invented doctrine.
The group rights theory.
Exactly. And so I started doing research at that time, basically on the original writings of the Founding Fathers and the debates and the conventions that ratified the Constitution, debates on the Bill of Rights and all. And that's really what got me started on the topic. And over the years, I just kept doing that research and finally started publishing it.
You also have a fascinating book on the Swiss versus the Nazis.
There were actually two books that I did. I'd always been fascinated by that subject. I had begun going to Switzerland at least once a year back in 1991, and I was doing shooting matches and taking pictures and doing articles on that, because in that society, you can walk down the street with a military rifle on your shoulder and people just think, oh, there must be a match in town. It didn't mean anything evil. So I did a book called Target Switzerland and then another one called The Swiss and the Nazis, and having both to do with the way that this Alpine Republic was able to survive in the shadow of the Third Reich.
Huh. Just fascinating. Are you able to bring guns over to Switzerland to shoot, or do you have to borrow when you're there?
You know, you're able to do that. It's legal, but I prefer using their guns because their current service rifle is the one that is used most often in matches, and that's the only time I get a chance to shoot that one. It's called the Assault Rifle 90. There was a semi-auto version that was imported for sporting purposes some time ago into the U.S., but then when the ATF changed the criteria and what was sporting yesterday was no longer sporting the next day, it's no longer allowed to be brought in. So it's an extremely accurate, very well-made rifle.
Is that, in effect, the G3?
No, the G3 was a 7.62 caliber, a larger caliber. This one is equivalent to our 5.56 caliber, a smaller caliber, a lighter gun with the folding stock, and just extremely well-made gun by SIG, the Swiss arms maker.
mm-hmm.
which I guess is no longer, well, they merged with Sauer, you know, it's Sig Sauer now, and they're in Germany, but at the time they were being made in Switzerland, and they still have a facility there to take, you know, gunsmiths the rifles and whatnot.
You point out in your, oh, by the way, that the whole idea of the sporting purpose test is a Nazi-originated concept.
That was something that goes way back, and actually, it goes even further back. I mean, the Weimar Republic's mm-hmm. 1928 Gun Control Act had that, some of that language, and then Hitler's Gun Control Act of 38 had some, and the 38 law even banned the 22 hollow point ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
And the only entity that protested at the time, this is starting to get into the subject of my new book, is mm-hmm. the Forest Service, those who were involved with hunting. So they realized that hunting small game required that kind of ammunition, but their voice went unheard.
Mm-hmm. You point out in your introduction to gun control in the Third Reich, disarming the Jews and enemies of the state, which is just a wonderful book for people who want a historically accurate and extremely well-researched. I don't think there's a single page without footnotes on it. You point out in your introduction that you do not, quote, crudely claim that gun control led inexorably to the Holocaust, unquote. You say that what's worse is the failure of scholars to come to terms between disarmament policies and oppression, unquote. Why is that worse?
I don't know if worse is the best word there.
I'm only quoting you.
Yeah. The United Kingdom has extremely restrictive gun control. They haven't had a Holocaust. Well, maybe they had a mini one when Cromwell sent his soldiers to Ireland, but the 1600s. But what's always gotten me, and I began studying this subject back in the 60s because it was brought up in congressional debates about whether there are any parallels to the kind of controls that were in Nazi Germany. And the kind of restrictive measures that are promoted here. And it just amazed me completely that no historian has ever mentioned this subject. And back then there was a Library of Congress study that claimed that the Nazis never used gun control and they wouldn't have even thought about doing that. And they never used, you know, registration records to look up anybody that they didn't like. And so I can't vouch for my sentence offhand there, but I think what's always amazed me is why historians have ignored every topic, as you well know, virtually every aspect of the Third Reich has been put under a microscope, and there's thousands and thousands of books about it, and for some reason, this is the page that's always left out.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm recovering from a cold, and reading your book didn't help. It made me somewhat sicker. I know I was looking at reality,
yeah.
But, I mean, you could see this rolling train wreck of human rights just unfolding in front of you in perfectly logical and well-documented ways. I could see this, and, you know, it's like watching it's like watching Flight 93. You know how it ends, but it's still thickening. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's the detail. I mean, I have to say there were some heroic voices. There were people who wanted to stand up, and it didn't work out, and
no, it didn't.
People who... It really gave you inspiration, but then there came the bad ends, and
mm-hmm.
it's an incredible story.
By the time Hitler had finally consolidated his power, what was the state of German private weapons ownership and training by then?
Well, first, in terms of consolidation, it was a continual process. But when he first came into power, became chancellor in 1933, there was this violent onslaught of not only turning the police forces against people, but using the SA and using the brown shirts and whatnot as pseudo police forces to go after political enemies. And so the first thing that was done in the midst was this, basically everybody who's a political opponent of Nazism is a communist. And therefore we're going to go after the communists. But that meant social democrats and it meant people in the centrist party, anybody who was not politically reliable. And so, at that point already, they were looking up gun licenses and canceling gun licenses of people who were politically unreliable and basically, you know, busting in their houses. But then that first year was very violent, but then we go through a period of forcing in the line where all the institutions of society basically were put under the Nazi heel. I'm talking about labor unions, social clubs, athletic clubs of all kinds, including shooting clubs.
Gleichschaltung, is that what it's called?
Gleichschaltung, yeah.
Gleichschaltung, the forcing into line. I learned a new word reading your book. I learned several. Gleichschaltung.
And the gun clubs, for example, had to have Nazis in control, like as officers. And if you didn't like that, if you were in a club and you refused, the head of the club was going to be picked up by the Gestapo. So you have a continuation of the tentacles of power going into every aspect of society. Just in terms of the gun issue, you have this tightening up, meaning that already a lot of the political enemies have been disarmed right at the beginning. There were also actions against the Jewish population, searches and seizures, but it was not like it would become later. When you go from 33 to 38, there was kind of an in-between period. You know, there was the Berlin Olympics and things were lightened up for that some. But at the same time, there was the Gestapo was getting more into power in terms of telling local police what to do. And so there was a directive issued in 1935 by Werner Best, who was the chief legal advisor to the Gestapo.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, he was second in command in the Gestapo even, basically saying that guns in the hands of Jews is a danger to public safety, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that it would be a very hard case to make that a gun license could ever be issued to a Jewish person. So this directive went from the Gestapo to all police stations throughout Germany. But realize at the time it was not illegal at all for a Jew to have a gun. The only people prohibited from gun ownership at that time were gypsies. And it was not until 1938 when the Night of the Broken Glass, Kristallnacht, happened that it became unlawful for Jews to have guns.
The surprising thing about it is the second in command of the Gestapo, he may have been imprisoned after World War II, but he lived all the way until 1989.
Yeah, he had a very interesting history. In 1931, he was a Nazi official who devised secret plans if there was a Nazi takeover. And a couple of the points in that plan was that all food would be denied to Jewish people. Another part of the plan was that anybody who didn't surrender their guns to the SA within 24 hours of the announcement would be executed. And he went on, this all came out in 1931, it was called the Boxheimer Incident.
Mm-hmm.
That was the name of an estate where the records were discovered. He went on to become, as I said, an official in the Gestapo. The individual who had revealed these documents was mysteriously murdered right in about 33 or 34. And then, of course, Werner Best is the one who issues this directive from the Gestapo not to issue gun licenses to Jews. And then when the war came, he went on to be the Gestapo in Paris, enforcing the very rule that he had written about. When a country was occupied, posters went up that you turn in your guns within 24 hours or you're subject to being executed. So he administered that in France. And then Denmark had a policy that was not adverse to Jews, and there came a time when Denmark was ordered to, basically they were going to round up the Jews, the Nazis were.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a heroic effort to take the virtually entire Jewish population of Denmark to Sweden by boat, which worked.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wonderful book on that called Rescue in Denmark. But at the same time, that was when the same decree was declared in Denmark for the first time, turn in your guns within 24 hours or we execute you. And guess who was there on assignment from France? It was this very same Werner Best.
Hmm. Hard to believe they let him live after World War II. Hey, we're way over time for a break, but you're too fascinating to interrupt, so stand by. And
go for it.
In Gun Control in the Third Reich is the name of the book, Disarming the Jews and Enemies of the State. It's published by the Independent Institute, which you might also, if you have a few bucks, consider financially supporting. I'm going to end that music a little early because I can't stand to listen to it. It's part of history. It's part of history, but it just makes me sob. So, and that's not their national anthem anymore by any means. When did they change it? Do you have any idea?
I can't remember. Oh, man.
It's okay. In 1928 and again in 1932, the Weimar Republic passed laws, and I'm going backwards a little bit in a timeline here from what we've been talking about. But in 28 and 32, the Weimar Republic passed laws enforcing registration. How was their compliance at the time?
first of all, compliance was never very good from the beginning. If you go back to 1918, 1919, there were decrees passed basically disarming everybody. The Versailles Treaty had something to do with that. It also had to do with repressing communist revolt that was going on. And basically, these decrees were ignored. And that was one of the reasons in 1928 that was given for passing that law, was to make a law that could actually be enforced and people would actually go by. You know, whether that would come to pass or not is something else. It's very difficult to judge compliance, except to say this: who always obeys these laws? Law-abiding people. Criminals don't. Political upstarts who are involved in criminality don't. And at the time, in 1928, the Nazis had their illegal stockpiles. The communists had their illegal stockpiles. They were always fighting each other in the street. They were basically jockeying for power. So there was some compliance. It's difficult to say that people other than the law-abiding complied, though. And then the decree that you mentioned in 1932, it was actually came down in December of 31. The regulations were in 32. And that, by the way, came in after the Boxheimer documents had been discovered. And there was a period there of, well, the Nazis are going to take up arms and here comes the communists too. And so let's decree gun registration. And the compliance with that, again, is very difficult. I'll tell you, both law-abiding people did comply, and one of the people I'd like to say a few words about
Mr. Flatow?
Alfred Flatow.
Right.
And that has to do with the fact that the book has a couple of pages of his arrest report from 1938.
Boy, is it spotty.
He had dutifully registered three pistols and other kinds of weapons in 1932, and the records were there in the same place. And I'm talking about the report from 1938 now, mm-hmm. that German Jews were being disarmed in the weeks before Kristallnacht, and he came in to turn in his guns, and the arrest report says the record was still there, the registration record, where he had registered his guns in 1932, and they identified the exact police station. And what was the charge? Why was he being arrested? It said Jew with firearms. And then it had the place where you write in the section of law that was violated. That was blank. There was no violation of law.
Yeah, he was in full compliance.
Exactly. And then it said that same phrase that came from Werner Best back in the mid-30s, arms in the hands of Jews are a danger to public safety. The arrest report goes on to talk about basically him being there and they took his inventory, his what was on his person, you know, like you would happen when anybody would get arrested. And then he was turned over briefly to the Gestapo. We don't know how long. My guess is it was probably an interview, but there's no record of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big mystery to figure out the address, because that was not his home address, the crime scene. There was a blank for where the crime scene. And through extensive research with the help of my archivist in Germany, we found a phone book from 1938. We discovered that that address was no longer called that because it was named after some Nazi martyr, so-called. That was the address for the police station. That's how we figured out that these were Jewish men standing in line to turn in their guns in compliance with what they had been ordered to do.
Sounds like Connecticut a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, right. So when I found that name, the reason I'm saying Alfred Flatow, you say Flatow, is because the W is pronounced as a V in German, so you're right, you have the English pronunciation.
Yeah.
Every time I would find something like that, I would Google the name, and I was surprised to discover Alfred Flatow was a very famous man. He had been an Olympic champion for Germany in mm-hmm. the 1896 Athens Games, and he won gold medals in gymnastics,
mm-hmm.
and he became a prominent teacher and writer on athletics and gymnastics in Germany in the coming years. A very well-known individual, very well-respected, and he had a bicycle shop, and he was invited to go to the 1936 Olympics, but the persecution of Jews, of course, was well underway, and he didn't want to basically add to the farce, you know, stand up for Germany when everything was deteriorating in Germany. So another couple of things I wanted to mention about him, though, is that in 1938, when the disarming was going on before Kristallnacht, there was kind of a blank page in this issue, but then we know that in 1942,
mm-hmm.
he was ordered to be in one of the deportation trains, and one of his Olympic buddies from 1896 tried to intervene with the Reich Sports Authority, the head of the German Sports Authority, and the intervention was abruptly denied, and so he had to get on the train. He was sent to the Theresienstadt concentration camp,
mm-hmm.
where he died of starvation within just 2 or 3 months.
December of 1942. Just the perfect monument to Nazism.
We are the guardians of America, armed and free.
Indeed, we are the guardians of America, armed and free. And we have the special pleasure of having with us Stephen Halbrook. He's an attorney. He's been in practice for many years, over 30 now, right?
Yeah, more like 35, I guess.
Oh, boy. Said with a certain resignation of tone, he's written a number of books, the first which was That Every Man Be Armed in 1984, and the most recent, Gun Control in the Third Reich, Disarming the Jews and the Enemies of the State. It's extremely well documented. It's just, you know, speaking of the documentation, there was recently a controversy ignited by Slate magazine that said that the Germans, I think they were referring to the revamping of the 1938 Nazi weapons law over the 1928 Weimar law, that the Nazis actually made it easier on people to own guns. Was that just a plain lack of journalism, or was that agenda journalism?
That's agenda journalism. I'm not going to say the great lie technique, but this is a totally misinformed type of position. This goes back a few years. Back in the year 2000, I published my first lengthy article on this subject of the Nazi gun laws and how that changing the 28 law had been studied for 5 years, and I found all those documents. And so I published this article in 2000, Arizona International Law Review. And there was a response to that by Bernard Harcott, a law professor, where he basically took the position that you just mentioned, that, well, Hitler was really the gun owner's best friend, and they didn't disarm anybody, and they encouraged gun ownership, and so on and so forth. Well, here's the reality. In 1933, when they came to power, they used the Weimar gun law to disarm their enemies, because it had all these weasel words about disarming enemies of the state and proper persons. I mean, some of these same laws you see in American laws today. A person's not a proper person to have a gun, you know, like, very subjective. So they could disarm anybody they wanted to. And when they passed the 38 law, they changed a couple of things that could be interpreted as liberalization. But when you're the officials and you can disarm anybody you want to say that a minor change in the law like that, like in the age that a person could buy a rifle or something of that type, that's meaningless. If you can decree the disarming of entire sector of the people in Germany, like the 38 law, for example, said that no Jew could be in the firearm industry. It didn't ban possession, but then a regulation under that was decreed by Interior Minister Frick at the time of Kristallnacht, making it illegal for a Jewish person to have a gun. And then side by side with that was the SS Chief Heinrich Himmler's decree that a Jew could get 20 years in a concentration camp for possession of a gun. So don't give me this stuff about liberalizing the gun laws. And in fact, in this exchange that I had with Professor Harcott, he said, well, of course it's well known that they wanted to disarm and kill the Jews. Well, you would think that would be enough to end the discussion, wouldn't you?
Well, it probably depends on what your view of Jews is, I suppose.
Right. And of course, you can't just look at the words of a law and think that you understand how the gun policy is implemented in that society.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've already mentioned, there was already the directive by Gestapo leader Werner Best that you wouldn't issue gun licenses to Jews, and yet, of course, the 38 law had gun licenses being acquired for acquisition of handguns. So to say it was a liberalization is just bunk.
Does it stun you talking about Jews? I guess as the outgoing executive director of JPFO, I'm morally obligated to ask you, Does it stun you today when you encounter Jewish people? And I know you work with a lot of Jewish lawyers who are on the good guy side, Alan Gura and David Kopel, whom you work with at the Independent Institute, and quite a few other good ones, and even some great ones that aren't Jewish, like Dave Hardy. Does it stun you today when you encounter Jewish people who learned nothing about the right to keep and bear arms from the Holocaust?
Well, I think that might relate to some of the mainstream Jewish organizations where there's always, for at least a long time, there's been a tendency to support gun control measures. And let me say, what a contrast. I even put this in the introduction to the book when the Keller case was before the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Your organization, Jews for Preservation of Gun Ownership, filed an amicus brief, very well done amicus brief.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of the Jewish organizations, along with Christian pacifist organizations, signed briefs, a brief rather, a joint brief, in support of upholding the D.C. handgun ban.
Mm-hmm.
And basically saying that the problem with Nazi Germany was they just disarmed Jews, and they should have just disarmed everybody. And can you imagine? I mean, so the German police and the German military should have had guns and nobody else?
Well, there's a name for that kind of a place. It's called a police state.
Right. I mean, can you imagine that it was just an unfair gun policy. The restrictions were fine. And what a contrast. I mean, I have to
say. You know what that reminds me of? Dred Scott. Oh, all the citizens are equal, but he's not a citizen because, well, he's black.
Right. Black people have no, African Americans have no rights that the white population is bound to respect. That's what the court says.
You know, in Arizona, it has no effect in law in Arizona. Someone puts up, except at a government building, and except at a government building, if someone, or a nuclear generating station, or a hydroelectric facility, or a bar, if somebody puts up a sign that says no guns here, it has no effect in law. But those of us here in the right to keep and bear arms community, and I'm a co-founder of the Arizona Citizens Defense League, we call that a "we don't serve your kind here" sign.
Right.
And we say, gee, I guess now we know how segregation feels. And even though it has no effect in law, we don't usually patronize a business like that. So, some of the people who are starting to get it are in New York and New Jersey. The FBI briefs some of the local rabbis there, or not just the FBI, but New Jersey State Police and New York State Police, actually brief the synagogues about specific threats they learn about through intel, and they're making it somewhat easier for people to get premise permits for carrying pistols at synagogues. And I think that's just, it's kind of stunning in a way. In a way, it's not, because, if you'll pardon the phrase, they're having a come-to-Jesus moment about the right to keep and bear arms. But, I mean, even guys who are just dead set against carrying a gun most of the time, when you threaten them, amazing how they go for training. And then some of the police agencies have actually been conducting training in synagogues. It's fascinating.
I think that's excellent. And, after 9/11 especially, we've had incidents against synagogues in this country. And the whole idea that you're not going to protect them with arms, it's just incredible to me. Down the street from us is the Jewish Community Center. We've been a member a long time. They've got an excellent pool. And they had a guard there, and it was just this guy with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And especially after 9/11, you remember the mentality back then. I mean, it was a lot of consciousness about we need to protect ourselves and our facilities. And,
yeah, it was a flag. It was a flag on the pole outside and an H-70 in the closet next to the front door.
So it's something that, I mean, I'm glad to hear there's better consciousness about it in some places, because that's really needed, that you've got to have armed guards,
yep,
particularly in places that might be targets.
Yeah, when you have places that are targets and you have something precious, you protect it. To the phones, and Tony, you're live on America Armed and Free with Stephen Halbrook. Your comment or question, please.
Thank you, Charles.
You're welcome.
Mr. Halbrook. The question I wanted to ask, I'm currently in the process of reading your book, and it is a fascinating book. What is your prognosis for this country with your experience looking at the Third Reich's process of gun control?
Well, my feeling, it's a lesson about be careful what you wish for. And the whole reason this gets interjected into the gun debate here, and it started in 1968, was gun registration bills were being promoted in Congress. Congressman John Dingell, who's still there, stood up and said, this sounds like stuff that was like 23 years ago when the war ended, it was Nazi Germany. And I'm not saying that it's the same situation. And I would not say that today either, but let's be clear about the history lesson. We need to learn from history. We don't want to repeat it. And I'm not going to say we're on the verge of becoming like a Nazi society. There's no Holocaust going on. And most people don't get the knock on the door in the middle of the night and be taken off by the Gestapo. But it's something to be very careful about. You only have your liberties once, and if you lose them, if you don't have the Second Amendment rights, that can happen. And therefore, we don't want a gun registration system. Let me give you an example. The European Union now requires gun registration of all legal guns in every country. Germany was the first country to adopt that. They proudly announced at the beginning of last year that they had a central registration, electronic, of all legal guns in that society. You would think they could have learned a lesson. So I don't believe we're on the verge of any kind of parallel situation to what happened in Nazi Germany. We're more like in the Weimar Republic when we get all these wacky proposals about gun registration. And fortunately, we've got a different history. We have the Second Amendment has been well respected in this country by the people at large, and they exercise that right in a very wide scale.
And thanks to some of your work and some of the people that work with you, the right to keep and bear arms, legally speaking, is moving forwards, not backwards in the United States.
Well, we just hope it keeps going that way.
And welcome back to America Armed and Free. We have the joy and special pleasure of having with us Stephen Halbrook. He's the author of many books, the first being That Every Man Be Armed in 1984. This one, Gun Control in the Third Reich, Disarming the Jews and the Enemies of the State. It's a phenomenal book, amazingly researched. You told me off the air you've been writing this book for 15 years?
Well, to do the research, yes. It involves some trips to Germany to go to archives. It involved a lot of review of documents. I have several drawers of file cabinets full of documents that go back to the 20s and 30s, and they're all in German. And to review those and to try to translate the parts I was able to translate and get professional help for other parts, it was quite a job. And then to write it and put it all together, I mean, it was just an immense amount of work. And notice that it was a blank slate. You won't find any book on the Third Reich to mention this subject, and I never could understand why not, and why little old me had to do this, but somebody had to do it.
Be careful when you say professional help. It may make you a prohibited possessor soon. All right. Greg's been very patient. Greg, you're on with Stephen Halbrook of the book, Gun Control in the Third Reich.
The point is that it's kind of a cautionary tale, right?
Well, two things. One, yes, it's a cautionary tale. Two, it's part of history, and usually you don't have to have a reason to write history. And so if you want to know what these people can get out of it today, it's a cautionary tale, but it's a part of history that should have been written anyway.
Yeah, the history side, I agree with. What's your thought on Australia and their way they changed their gun laws?
I hear that the people in the rural areas don't really go by it very much, but I'm not well-versed. I haven't researched it. You know, Australia was threatened in World War II by Japan. And, you know, these gun bans, they come about in times when there doesn't seem to be any threat. Look what happened in England. Actually, that started in 1919, disarming the English people. And then in 1939, they go to war with Germany, and they find that they have no defenses. Their population is disarmed. So what happens, you had Americans raising not just funds, but collecting arms voluntarily from U.S. gun owners to send to England. There were advertisements in the New York Times and National Rifleman magazine and other places, and there was a committee officially doing that.
Saying that we were selling scrap steel to Japan.
Do you know where the British SAS, their original commandos, got their Thompson submachine guns?
From the gangsters?
No. They got them from American ranchers who used them for going after coyotes. They carried them on horseback with stick magazines, not with drum mags. And they collected hundreds of them. They were privately owned machine guns, and they shipped them all to England. And when England was all done with them at the end of the war, do you know what England did with them?
Probably dump them in the ocean.
That's exactly correct.
Yeah. What about the countries like South Asia, where it seems to be pretty much, you know, Pakistan, Afghanistan, where a guy if he's able-bodied, he can carry a pistol or any kind of gun, right?
And they make AKs in little craft shops.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In parts of Pakistan. So
we should be so lucky here.
Well, I think you still can. There are guys making those things in town with components.
Yeah, that's
not,
true.
Maybe
there's,
not AKs, but...
AKs and ARs. There's a lot of people that make them, but I mean in little craft shops. I think that would be just so cool.
From scratch.
Yeah.
I think that the guy that killed the guy in the theater for texting probably would not work at helping the argument.
Well, I don't think that has anything to do with AKs or ARs, and you know...
But it has to do with armament and the
general population. No, it has to do with rationality.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy was a police officer. You would think he had judgment. Evidently, it slipped. You know?
Wow.
You're supposed to control your emotions. You know, that speaks worse for police officers than it does for gun ownership. All right, you have a good day. Richard, you're live on America Armed and Free with author Stephen Halbrook of Gun Control in the Third Reich, and I believe you've read at least a part of his book, right?
In fact, I've had the pleasure of reading it cover to cover, and not only is it a fascinating book, Mr. Halbrook, but I think this is an important book in addition to being fascinating. And nobody seems to have done this work before and in pointing out the documenting the role of gun control and what it played in the oppression of the German people. In reading your book, one of the things I got out of it was a progression, and if I'm not correct in this, correct me, but the progression that I got out of it was the German government started with some gun registration, and then that progressed into strict registration, and that progressed into outlawing gun ownership by Jews, and that progressed into outlawing gun ownership for everyone, and registration then of guns progressed into registering people, and then registering their property. And then that progressed eventually into the government murdering people by the millions. And you pointed out you don't believe there's a direct line between gun registration and the ovens, but it certainly played a major, major role in that progression. My question is, how do you think the American government today, based on your research in the German period, how do you think the government today, the American government, would go about disarming the American people, if that's what they really intended to do? What would be the tactics?
Well, that's where I think we've learned the lessons. And notice that we Americans learned the lesson directly. It was in when these things were going on in Germany, they were very widely reported in the U.S. If you go back to the old issues of the New York Times, they reported about the 1931 decree about registering guns. They reported about the Boxheimer document where Werner Best had advocated execution of people before any of these events took place, before the Nazis took power. Reports about Kristallnacht, reports about occupied countries where you got executed for gun ownership. So in 1941, Congress actually passed a law about requisitioning property, knowing that we were getting pulled into the war, but it forbade registration of guns and it forbade confiscation of guns. And it reaffirmed Second Amendment rights because there had been domestically people promoting registration. The 1934 National Firearms Act required registration of machine guns and short-barreled shotguns, but the original bill was going to require registration of all handguns. And the Attorney General of the United States at that time and some of his cronies kept promoting that idea. It didn't go away until the war came, you know, when you've got all these gun control measures, and when a war comes, people change their tune, just like happened with the Brits. So in this country, people are conscious of their Second Amendment rights, and we're also very conscious of the need for anonymous gun ownership. And so you don't have the kind of record systems here that would make possible what you have in other countries in terms of confiscating registered guns.
I am one who greatly opposes concealed carry permits. I think Charles would disagree with me on this. I would advise people do not get a concealed carry permit. Just go ahead and concealed carry and invoke what I would call citizen nolly, sort of like jury nolly. This is a law that is not beneficial for the people. Invoke citizen nolly and just concealed carry. Don't get a permit for it, because that permit system can be the beginning of a registration system, which then the Nazis, the Gestapo, as I read in your book, when they came looking for guns, what they did was go to the local police stations and get the gun registration records, and then went and told on people and confiscated their guns, ransacked their houses, and in some cases carted them off to concentration camps. And so the gun registration laws that existed at the time were the beginning or a major tool in rounding up people.
Dr. Halbert?
Yes, that's exactly right. A lot of these things are double-edged swords. The same could be said, like, for hunting licenses. When the Nazis invaded various countries, they would get the hunting license records. And, you know, we haven't had a big push by people to say we shouldn't have hunting licenses, but that's just always a danger, too, because you've got the potentiality that a government would figure out who's the gun owners based on that. And I'm not advocating not having hunting licenses, but these are all things to consider. That's why, at least with so far at the federal level, we've had a real tug-of-war about background checks. You know, the National Instant Background Check System. Those records, when you go in a gun store, those records are required to be destroyed within 24 hours. And that's the law. But when it first came out, when the Brady Act was first passed and this was implemented in the Clinton administration, Attorney General Reno, Janet Reno, said, we're keeping the records for 6 months. But we litigated that issue in a case called NRA versus Janet Reno. But it took congressional action to take the law back to what it was supposed to do, which the law said, once the person's cleared for the sale, the record has to be destroyed.
One of the things Janet Reno said subsequently is there's no way to delete the data.
It's always a concern of mine that some person could just take a stick disk and download everything. We've seen how that's been done.
Come on, Dr. Halbrook, come on. You're going to tell me somebody's going to walk into a secure facility and somehow or other surreptitiously remove data? That's ridiculous. Oh, wait a minute. No, that one, that might be a problem.
It might be by an employee.
Yeah.
So
all right.
You have that problem, and then you also have the problem of hacking in the records. So if you have a system of registration, especially if the records are electronic, you could have people setting up burglaries and doing all kinds of nefarious things with that information.
Yeah, I'm sure that the government archives are every bit as secure as, say, Target and Neiman Marcus.
Probably less secure. There's all those State Department records. I mean.
Yep. All right, stand by.
Tyrants do as they please. These Bill of Rights freedoms with which we are blessed. Without the second, what good are the rest?
What a great rhetorical question. I know the guy that wrote that song. Hell of a fella, as my grandfather used to say. Have you ever heard that song? It's called The Guardian?
No.
I'll email it to you. I wrote it for Aaron. I wrote the lyrics to it, about 90% of them, for Aaron about, when was it? I'm trying to think. It's about 12 years ago now. But
okay.
It brings to mind a question. In one second, I'll be with you. It talks about, that song talks about a disarmed population can be brought to its knees, and that tyrants can do as they please, and the Bill of Rights freedoms with which we're blessed, without the second, what good are the rest? Would it have made a difference, do you think, in terms of the Holocaust, if Jews had not been disarmed beforehand? If there'd never been a registration law or a confiscation, a disarmament of Jews? Let's narrow it down to before the Holocaust. What do you think would have been the results of Kristallnacht if the Jews had still been armed in Berlin?
Well, I can tell you what the Nazis thought. They were very emphatic on disarming the Jews. Why? There must have been something to it. They feared resistance. And what kind of resistance? It might not have been total resistance in the sense that, and certainly there wouldn't have been an overthrow of the state, but certainly individual resistance or resistance by small groups. You could have had a lot of brown shirts killed. If you look at what happened, the systematic disarming of the Jewish population started several weeks before Kristallnacht. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Sure.
The Nazis were tightening up the exploitation and economic confiscation against the Jewish population. They didn't want any resistance. So in the weeks before Kristallnacht, they were disarming Jews in Berlin and throughout Germany. This was not made public until actually Kristallnacht happened, when Helldorff, the police president of Berlin, announced that they had been doing this for some time and reporting on the results of the numbers of guns and so forth that were confiscated. But they thought that there was something to it, that there could be resistance, and therefore they were going to disarm these Jews. And so then they just needed an incident. And what happened? a young Polish Jewish teenager walked into the German embassy in Paris. Herschel Greenspan was his name.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very upset, and he shot the third in command there, a diplomat, and that person eventually died in three days. And then that was the excuse for Kristallnacht. Now, there are some people who think that he might have been put up to doing that, not consciously necessarily, but tricked into doing it. But whatever the case, that was the impetus. And so then the Nazis said, all Jews all in the world, everywhere in the world, are the enemies of the German people. And then that's when you have the attacks. You have the rampages. There was Hitler was having a meeting with other Nazis in Munich. He got together with propaganda minister Goebbels. When they found out that the diplomat had died, they knew that the time had come when they could try to use that for the impetus. And it was basically go on the rampage, turn the brown shirts loose, the police and firefighters should not intervene. And what did they do? They broke into houses, they ransacked the houses, they broke open the businesses, they burned down the synagogues. And Goebbels said that this will show the Jews, and he said that Helldorf has totally disarmed the Jews of Berlin, and things will keep moving ahead. Basically, we'll make them pay. And so this went on for 2.5-3 days. In the meantime, they rounded up 20,000 Jewish men. And at that time, why did they do that? It was a press conference that Goebbels gave for the international press. And first he denied they had rounded anybody up. And then he came back and admitted that, or he claimed that they were in possession of weapons illegally. Now, there obviously were some that had weapons, but most of them were just basically rounded up and put in the concentration camp. Then they had to pay blackmail to get out. So, I mean, getting back to your question, this comes up all the time. Well, it wouldn't have made any difference. I think it would have made some difference. We don't know how much difference it would have been.
We don't. If you look at standards of comparison, in Alexander Solzhenitsyn's book, Gulag Archipelago, he said that if every communist or raiding party had come to their door, had been met with a fusillade of gunfire, there would have been a lot less people in their gulags.
There's no question. And before, once the war started, once the so-called final solution had been decided on, they were still searching these Jews for weapons when they took them away. Their apartments were searched, their baggage was searched, and then they were put on the trains to go to the east, supposedly to work. And instead they were going to death camp. But there's always potential there for resistance. That's why in occupied countries, just the fact the Nazis themselves knew there were some people who didn't turn in their guns, it was created uncertainty. And any uncertainty that was created was a good thing.
Have you read Unintended Consequences by John Ross?
I've read parts of it. It's a novel, so I don't read novels.
I don't blame you.
I'm very familiar with the book, though, yes.
One of the things that Ross points out through one of his characters is that if you look at the pictures, the photos of concentration camp guards with a rifle slung, none of them, the 98 Mauser, you can tell if it's cocked by looking at the position of the bolt. None of them were. And any minor amount of resistance would have easily overcome a guard or two and led to all of the rest of them being overcome. And the people were just cowed.
They were, they were heroic examples, though, of different characters. The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising was just a fantastic thing that happened. There's a lot of good books. Several of the partisans who were involved in that wrote books about their experiences, and every one of them said that the toughest thing was to find guns. We started with just a very small number of guns. Most of us had no experience with guns, and we were able to. They held the Nazis off for several weeks. They stopped the deportations to the extermination camps for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them escaped and lived to keep fighting in partisan movements. And
right.
Too bad there were not two, three mini Warsaw Ghetto Uprisings.
Yeah, the ZOB, right?
Yes. Don't ask me to pronounce the Polish.
No. We've already exceeded the bounds of legal scholarship by asking you to pronounce things in German. And we have Richard calling back. He has evidently stimulated another question. Go right ahead.
Well, just to put a further point on about a three-line quote, it's on page 212. It's Hitler himself speaking in April of 1942, and he said, about three lines, the most foolish mistake we could possibly make would be to allow subject races to possess arms. History shows that all conquerors who have allowed their subject races to carry arms have prepared for their own downfall by doing so. It's Hitler's view of the importance of gun control.
interesting that you've usurped one of the questions I was going to ask, but I love it when someone pays that much attention. Stephen, your quick comment on that. We're running into our last break.
Hitler didn't write a lot of things that relate to anything of substance. He made lots of speeches, but it's hard to pin him down. And if you look at the, like, Mein Kampf, it's just a lot of crazy rambling, nonsensical. So quotes like the one that you just read are just jewels because it shows his attitude. And you can see the kind of dictatorship he created, but it wasn't like he continuously made comments about, oh, well, we need to disarm people and do this and that to them. And when you look back about his speeches, they're just rambling, the ramblings of a maniac. So anyway, that quote is a very good one to capture.
All right.
Policy.
We're up on our last break of the show. Stand by. And welcome back to the last segment of America Armed and Free. I want to go back to an earlier thing that we were talking about, Dr. Werner Best. We were talking about him earlier. He wrote a memo. He was the chief political advisor to the Gestapo. He wrote a December 16, 1935 memo, issuance of weapons permits to Jews, to all Gestapo state police and political police, just the thought of that, authorities in Prussia and the states. The text started, with regard to the issuing of permits of firearms permits to Jews, the regular police authorities must always obtain the opinion of the German of the Geheimstapolizei. Did I say it wrong? I'm sure I did.
Yeah, Gestapo.
Gestapo,
yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Authorities, on the political reliability of the individual applicant, I direct that the following be heeded. In principle, there will be very few occasions where concerns will not be raised regarding the issuance of firearms permits to Jews. As a rule, we have to assume that firearms in the hands of Jews represent a considerable danger to the German people. Therefore, in the future, an extreme measure of scrutiny will have to be applied to the question of political reliability of the applicant in all cases where an opinion needs to be given about the issuance of firearms permits to Jews. Only in this way will be able to prevent numerous Jews from obtaining firearms and causing danger to the German population. Now, by my calculator, that is only 79 years ago that he wrote that. What I want to know is, in your experience, did that level of hatred dissipate, or does it still simmer somewhere in Europe or maybe somewhere else?
Well, I think about the answer to that. If you look at the illustrations of the book, you will see that exactly in German, the document that you just read from, with an English translation and a picture of Werner Best. And it's an incredible document. He acted like it was an emergency, but this inquiry had gone to his office weeks or even months before, and he finally got this memo out. So it wasn't very urgent after all. It's hard to say. I mean, I think one problem we're dealing with in Europe is the immigration of Muslim populations and anti-Jewish outbursts in places like France, as an example. As far as carry over traditional Europeans being anti-Semites, I suppose it exists. It can't possibly be at the same level. And I have to say, I've always thought this was a manufactured hatred. In other words, the Nazis used anti-Semitism basically to steal the wealth of the Jewish population. They could have picked any number of groups to do that, and they focused on them. They maybe because there was a traditional anti-Semitic thought in Europe. But you just don't go to those depths, to those measures, to just because of some theory. And it seems to me that the so-called Aryans thought they were entitled to the wealth of the Jewish people, and this was one good way to get it. That's why you had all the confiscation of property. They wanted to run the Jews out of Europe. This was before the final solution. It was to get them out of Europe and take their goods before they left.
I never thought I would say this to you, but I must respectfully disagree. And I'll tell you, I think that if all they wanted was to get the wealth of the Jews, they could have confiscated it all and expelled them, and it would have cost, they would have made more, and it would have cost them less than exterminating them. It was a huge operation to exterminate 6 million people. That were, what, 17? I think there were 17 camps, 17 extermination camps. There were certainly more concentration camps than that. That's a huge infrastructure. It could be argued that if they didn't do that to their population, they might well have won World War II, or at least been able to sue for peace in a much better position, based on some retaining some of the brain power and also some of the muscle that people would have probably fought for had the Nazis
not
done it.
You're absolutely right about that. You know, that was later. I mean, the first deal was we're going to get rid of them, but when the war came, everything changed. And to use up those kind of resources, the trains and the personnel and everything else, just to kill people who aren't bothering you when you could put them to work.
Right.
I mean, it was pretty incredible that they would do that. It was, but that's what, yeah, what the theory I had about economics, that certainly didn't hold in that period.
Well,
I mean, they were just maniacs.
There's a word, yeah, there's a word in Spanish for that. It's mashugana. Back to what you were saying, is there any point at which, if you could put your pen down on that point in history, that the use of gun control, the way they did it, could have been arrested? Was there any point at which there was a tipping point, in your view, that it could have been, that it could have not proceeded forward? Or was it just a greased rail going downhill?
That's really hard, and it goes back deeper in history. In the 1848 revolution in Germany, there were calls for a Bill of Rights, including the equivalent of our Second Amendment. And that failed, and so you had authoritarian societies continuing, and although you have a flourishing of culture in Germany, you don't have the kind of traditions of liberty that we have here, or in any of those countries, because a lot of these same policies were being enacted in other countries. So I think what's really made America unique is our Bill of Rights and the idea that the people understand their rights and they fight for them, and you didn't have those traditions. I don't know. I don't think history is inevitable in what happens. I think choices can be made, and there might have been a time in the 20s because there was certainly opposing voices. The same debates you hear in this country today, pro and anti-gun, those very same arguments were being made in Germany in the 1920s. So had it gone a different way, things might have been different.
History does repeat itself. How is gun ownership in Germany today? Do you know? I mean, you've been back.
Yeah.
You've been there enough times. Is there a common ownership of guns?
To some extent. There's limits to the number of guns you can own. You have to be in gun clubs or have a hunting license or do other things, and you have to have training to do those things. In other words, if you're going to be in a gun club, before you're allowed to even buy a gun, you have to be in the club for like 2 years or something. It's an enormous task to get a hunting license in Germany. Once you do, then you can own hunting guns. But they really have some freedoms that you wouldn't expect, that were more freedoms than we had here during the time of the Clinton gun ban. There were guns there that you could buy that you couldn't buy here. And I was amazed. I visited the Czech Republic, by the way, after the fall of communism, and
mm-hmm.
you could buy magazines like Glocks with 17-round mags, and that was during the Clinton ban, where the magazines here for new guns had to be
10 rounds. Right.
So there's a lot more restrictions. They also inspect your house once a year. Affect your guns, the police do. You can do it, but it's a lot more restrictive.
Well, it's a lot less than it was under the Weimar. Well, actually, no, it's not less restrictive than Weimar, but much less
restrictive. More restrictive.
Yeah, yeah. Much more. But by the same token, at least you can. I understand that's why a lot of people in Germany have switch caliber pistols, because the frame is what counts. So they can have four or five different tops for a 1911 and change calibers, and still it's only considered to be one pistol. So, as they say in Spanish, oy vey. Anyway, I wish there was something, you know, some way to inject the spirit of liberty, not just, you know, for us, for you and for me, but so that everybody could experience it. I just wish there was some, you know, shot in the rump we could give people that would give them the desire for freedom. I just don't know how you do that.
Well, you know, we've lasted this long in this country, other than in a few states, gun ownership is relatively easy. And the more the people in the government promote gun restrictions, the more people buy them.
Right.
So we've got a constituency that just continues to grow.
Yep. Stephen, we're up against the stops for time. Do you have a website you want to give out?
www.stephenhalbrook.com. That's StephenHalbrook. Just Google my name, you'll find information. And if you want the book, you can buy it from Amazon or anywhere. Just Google the name of the book, Gun Control and the Third Reich.
All right. You have a great day.
Thank you, Charles. My pleasure.
My pleasure. In Liberty, I'm Charles Heller.
Great God.